From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, is the Trump administration denying American citizens on the border U.S. passports and paid sick leave? Can cities in Texas make it a thing? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. If you live on the U.S.-Mexico border, having a passport is especially important. You cannot legally cross back into the United States from Mexico without having one, and there are plenty of good reasons to cross into Mexico on a daily basis. Affordable health care, cheaper prescription drugs, visiting family, going to work, even to enjoy great food and culture. Having a passport has all sorts of benefits. But to be a U.S. citizen, born in the USA, and then be denied a U.S. passport, that can lead to a number of difficulties and life complications, and that's what's happening. Some Mexican Americans who live in South Texas who have applied for an American passport have been accused of fraud, and they're being jailed in immigration detention centers and have entered into deportation proceedings. Congressman Joaquin Castro, a Democrat from San Antonio, says one of the cases in question is from a San Antonio citizen.
I have a case right now of a veteran who's being denied a passport and has not been able to get that passport. And so I'm asking for a full accounting from the State Department of how many people are being denied their full rights of citizenship.
Castro is calling for a full congressional investigation into the Trump administration's practice of denying passports. The American Civil Liberties Union is also investigating these developments. Andre Segura is the legal director for the ACLU of Texas.
So this is something that we're looking into. We've read reports and have been hearing individual reports from attorneys on the border that passport denials are on the rise. And so this is denials of, you know, U.S. citizens who are applying or reapplying for passports and having those passports denied. So we're hearing that those denial rates are going up. And we're also hearing that the administration is challenging these passport applications and taking a lot of these cases to trial where they otherwise would have been dealt with just by, prior to trial by an attorney, providing more information.
People need to know that there's a history here and that the ACLU has been part of that history with people on the border, with declarations of you're not a citizen, dealing with midwife birthing at home.
That's right. I first heard about it in 2007 when the Bush administration was denying passports of people primarily along the southern border. We filed, the ACLU and the ACLU of Texas filed a lawsuit in 2008 challenging this practice, alleging that these passport denials were being done arbitrarily and discriminatorily based on a person's Mexican ancestry. And the reason that you mentioned midwives is that part of the suspicion is that the government had this list in which they had a number of midwives who were either suspected or had been found in some context to have provided a fraudulent birth certificate. On that basis alone, at the time, the government was denying outright passport applications to anyone who was born through the use of one of these midwives. And that was one of the biggest issues and one of the biggest things that we were able to remedy through a settlement with the government.
The accusation that the State Department is making in regards to these granting of passports is that these are all midwife birth certificates that were filled out, and they're saying that there may have been fraud or that there was rampant fraud at the time, and that they're asking these individuals to provide so many more documents to try to provide show them that they were actually born in the United States.
Right. And our concern is that they're using that to effectively and categorically prejudge anyone who comes out of this in that context. And what we were able to settle for was a fair process where people were not outright rejected simply because they were born through the use of a midwife that was on a list, that if they were required to provide additional documentation, that they knew what that documentation would be, that it was fair and consistent for everyone. And effectively, what we just want and should continue to be the case is that there just needs to be a fair process. So that's what we're going to be looking into to make sure that they are, in fact, being treated fairly. They're not being scrutinized more than other people because they're along the southern border. So these are all questions that we still need to figure out.
So to highlight, the timeline was that this has already been dealt with. It's been investigated. It's been litigated. There's been a solution that's been put in place. And it seemed to have been working, that it was identified that there may have been some problems in this process with people applying for passports who had been who have midwife birth certificates. Then y'all went to court, were able to come up with solutions. And now, under the Trump administration, that's being opened up. All of the remedies that y'all have put in place have been discarded. Is that it?
Well, on your last point about whether they've all been discarded, that's something that we need to figure out. We're really concerned about the reports that we're hearing that this is on the rise and that people are being treated unfairly. As you've heard and seen in reports about people who served in the military, former Border Patrol officials who are being denied passports, people who you wouldn't suspect. So, you know, whenever this happens, I think this is why this catches people's attention, because this is really denying a privilege and a right to U.S. citizens, to Americans and people along the border, Americans just like anyone else and need their passport, perhaps more than anyone else. Life on the border, as many people know, effectively requires a passport. A lot of these communities have families on both sides, shop on the Mexican side, seek medical attention at times, and frequently cross back and forth. And in order to cross, you now have to have a passport. So the denial of a passport for someone who lives along the Texas border is a huge deal.
And not just getting across and coming back, you need the passport, but frequently your citizenship is frequently brought into question, whether going through a checkpoint or just dealing with the oversaturation of DPS troopers in the area. To have a passport on you at all times, it is a way to try to kind of navigate this system that's developed down there of high suspicion.
Exactly. Often to go from town to town, for example, in the valley, you need a passport to get through checkpoints. And the way I describe it is, you know, people think it is a hassle to go through TSA when they fly now and then. For people along the border, oftentimes they have to go through a checkpoint every day, take their kids to school, to go to work, and they need their passport to do that. So they're getting that sort of TSA treatment as part of their regular life, and they need that passport and able to do it, whether it's right or wrong.
So do American citizens have a right to a passport?
Yes.
But sometimes can a passport be revoked for an American citizen?
I'm certain there may be some, like, security reasons. None of those have been sort of the question in these cases. You know, these are people like whose the genesis of this is, you know, because they're suspected of not having a legitimate birth certificate or being born in the United States or having some sort of derivative citizenship.
Having American citizens who are deprived of being able to acquire their passport, which is their right, that makes them effectively second-class citizens.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you are treating, you know, I think a lot of communities along the border are treated that way because of how Border Patrol operates in that region, because of checkpoints, because of the high amount of security and militarization around that area, including the wall. But yeah, denial of a passport is certainly treating people differently.
There have people who have applied for their passport and now they were arrested, put in jail, and now they are facing deportation.
Yeah, we've heard of those stories. Those are certainly concerning.
In that process, will they have an opportunity to make a case so that they don't get deported?
Yeah, they would be placed into immigration proceedings. You know, a lot of this depends on whether they're able to get an attorney. These matters are complicated, which sort of compounds the issue. In order to fight any of these cases and challenge the government's denial of a passport, if this goes all the way to a trial, that can cost a significant amount of money, which, you know, obviously a lot of people just don't have.
Now, we have the issue in and of itself, which is of individuals dealing with this circumstance, being denied passports, being jailed because they're asking for the passport, facing deportation because they're asking for a passport. And I guess overwhelmingly, we're talking about Latinos or Mexican Americans.
That is, I mean, this certainly the South Texas border is predominantly Latino by its demographics. And as we pled in our original complaint, this was predominantly impacting Latinos and predominantly those of Mexican ancestry.
So this must have some sort of effect on the overall Latino community. Are we going to see people afraid to ask for a passport, which they need and which they have a right to, but now there's a chilling effect and they can't ask for one because they're afraid of what could happen to them, even though they are American citizens?
Yeah, we're certainly concerned about the sort of chilling effect that this might have on these communities. And I don't think it's just because of this passport issue, right? I mean, the Trump administration, our own Texas governor, have enacted policies that are outright against immigrants, against communities of color, whether that's in the immigrants' rights context or in criminal justice issues. So I think they're seeing an administration that they don't believe really cares about their community, and this is having those effects. People, if they do have questions, I would recommend that they reach out to an attorney to talk about their individual cases.
You know, having to have a passport to cross the Rio Grande to go into Mexico for the day and come back, that's relatively a new thing. That's kind of a post 9/11 thing. It's been put a hardship on families. Passports are not cheap. If you want to get your entire family across to visit Abuelita or somebody, it's going to cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Why do we need a passport to get into Mexico?
You know, these are probably concerns that are, beyond what we're looking into right now. But, I do agree that for these communities, going back and forth and their families on both sides is a way of life. We would obviously want that streamlined as much as possible. Because not only do you need a passport, but the time that you have to wait going in and out, especially coming back into the United States, can be extremely lengthy.
So the ACLU led the charge last time this became an issue, and so you're getting things ready to go at it again?
Well, we're talking to attorneys. There are several attorneys who have been doing these cases as they come up. So we're certainly in contact with them. This is an issue. As you know, the ACLU is throughout the country an issue that's not only affecting Texans, though it's mainly seems to be. So there is a broad interest in this case, I think, because it really goes at the heart of, American rights of Americans and U.S. citizens, which we're obviously concerned about. So we're taking those next steps. We're taking this very seriously and hoping to get more information soon.
According to reporting from the Washington Post that broke the story, the U.S. State Department says they have not changed any policies or procedures in dealing with requests for U.S. passports from requesters on the border.
Right. And that's something that we're going to certainly attempt to verify as much as possible. We need to see that data. We need to look into it more closely. We need to talk to more people on the ground.
What do you tell people who live in that area who have a midwife birth certificate and they need a passport? Should they apply?
I don't think people should be in fear. I think if they have some concern, they should talk. The safest course is to talk to an attorney.
Andres Segura is the legal director of the ACLU of Texas. The ACLU is investigating reports that the Trump administration is denying requests for U.S. passports from American citizens in South Texas. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. For many of us, if we get the flu bug or if our child gets ill and can't go to school that day, we call the boss and take a sick day. Paid sick time off is a perk of the job, but it's not a perk that all workers get. For most hourly workers, calling in sick means they're going to miss a day's pay, something they can't afford to do when they're paycheck to paycheck existence. So when they get sick, they go to work, feeling miserable and spreading whatever virus or disease that they have to their co-workers and customers. The cities of Austin and San Antonio, though, have recently passed ordinances that require paid sick leave for local businesses. But state leaders like Attorney General Ken Paxton has warned that these ordinances violate state law and they attempt to supersede state law. The Texas Public Policy Foundation sued Austin over their ordinance and said it would cost the Austin economy $140 million. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals for the 3rd District granted a stay against the Austin paid sick leave ordinance while that appeal is pending. The court offered no opinion on the legality of that ordinance, but the ruling has put the effort to improve the lives of Texas workers on hold. Any real changes to the labor situation in Texas might actually depend on the results of the November election. Jose Garza is the executive director of the Workers' Defense Action Fund.
It's clear that there is a growing movement of people across the state who are demanding some solution to this problem. There are elected officials both in Austin and in San Antonio who have heard those calls and have taken action to make sure that people who work can take a day off when they get sick. So the city of Austin has passed an ordinance ensuring that everyone who works has the ability to take off when they get sick. And San Antonio also passed an ordinance which does the same thing. There are efforts underway in other cities across the state, and we expect this issue will only increasingly become a part of the dialogue across the state as we close in on Election Day and the opening of the state legislature.
One view of this is that your organization was able to force the city of San Antonio, the council, to take action. They didn't pass this out of the blue. There was a petition drive. It looked like it was going to go onto the charter election ballot. That scared the bejesus out of them. So they went ahead and passed it, knowing full well that this faced a court battle and it also faced the legislature, which is not in favor of paid sick time for hourly workers in Texas. Is that right?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. There are some strident voices in the state legislature who have spoken up against people being able to take a day off when they get sick. All of those strident voices have elections this November, and I think they should not get too far ahead of themselves. We should see how many of them come back. And then once we know that, then I think we can have a good and vigorous debate in the state legislature. The other thing to say is that it's clear that there are, again, special interests both out of state and in state who don't want to see this happen. They have taken to the courts to stop it. And I think what folks need to remember is that the only court that has weighed in on the substance of whether it was lawful for the cities to take this policy up on the merits have ruled that the out-of-state special interests aren't likely to succeed on the merits. Again, I think we are eager and excited to have this discussion in November. I think we're excited to have it once the legislature starts, and I think we're incredibly confident that we're going to prevail in court.
There's a lot of people out there saying that this is too much, that businesses will go out of business if they are required to offer their hourly workers paid sick time.
A couple of things to remember. First of all, there are over 41 jurisdictions that states and cities across the country who have adopted similar policies. And in each one of those places, local business continues to thrive and grow. What we have seen in each one of those places is all the fear-mongering that happened prior to the policy's passage, was not well-founded and did not come to pass. So I think there is just an overwhelming amount of evidence that makes clear that the fears that are being articulated by the business community won't ultimately be borne out.
Can you talk more about how the paid sick time works? How does a person accumulate the time and how is that held accountable?
Yeah, so the policy allows every person who works at this point, right, both in Austin and in San Antonio, to accumulate hours as they work, and I believe it's 1 hour for every 30 they work. The policy takes into account the size of businesses. So for businesses that have more than 15 employees, employees can accumulate up to 8 days of earned paid sick time a year. And for businesses that have 15 or fewer, it is six days that employees can accumulate. It is clear that independent contractors are not under the purview of this ordinance. And it further takes into account even smaller businesses who have five or fewer by giving them more time to prepare and more time before the law goes into effect.
Many people who have already this benefit that they get from their employer, I guess they tend to be not hourly workers. They get a straight 40, and they are, I guess, white-collar workers?
Well, I think what the data bears out is that there are people in all sectors and across classification, whether it's white-collar or hourly workers, who don't have this benefit. It is true that the majority of people who don't have this benefit are in the service sector, in construction, and in other sectors that I think we typically think of as being, that treat their employees as hourly employees. But there are, I think, significant percentages of white-collar sectors that also lack this benefit. I'm thinking off the top of my head, at least in Austin, something like 20% of people working, and I'm trying to remember the name of the sector precisely, but in a few of the white-collar sectors, I think it is clear that there are people in every sector of the economy who still lack this benefit.
Sure, like temp workers, office temps?
Well, I'm thinking of white-collar workers in technology jobs and legal jobs. There are a host of folks in what we typically think of as white-collar sectors who don't have this benefit. And as soon as I get to my computer, I'll send you the precise data. Again,
yeah.
It's true that the overwhelming, the majority of folks who don't have this benefit are in retail, in the restaurant industry, in construction. But there are significant portions of the workforce in what we think of as traditionally white-collar sectors who also lack the benefit. This is a benefit. This is a policy that would benefit people across sectors in the state of Texas.
There is an argument that says, well, I agree that we should have paid sick leave for our workers, but I don't think cities or even the state should make it a requirement, that is overreaching. I don't need the government to tell me how to handle my employees.
Well, listen, I think there are far too many people who work in Texas who have to make the hard choice between going to work sick and taking a pay cut. And for those people, they really shouldn't have to depend on winning the boss lottery. It shouldn't come down to whether or not they're lucky enough to have an employer who offers this benefit. It's a really basic thing that everyone who gets sick should be able to take a day off. That everybody who works should be able to take a day off when they get sick. And it shouldn't be left up to the benevolence of employers.
But that doesn't really get to the philosophical issue of the government having the ability to require paid sick leave. I mean, we can argue that if you're entered into the public economy, then there are certain things that the government can do in order to protect the rights of the workers.
Well, generally speaking, I think it is without question that the government has the ability to set a floor for basic standards that every employer has to meet to provide for good, healthy, safe jobs. This is a 100-year-old debate in our country that I think by now has been settled. I think that the overwhelming majority of people who live and work in Texas think that earned paid sick time is a basic standard that people who live and work in the state should have access to.
Right now, we're seeing really low unemployment. Workers should have the high hand in trying to improve their status against management and businesses. because, you know, technically there's a labor shortage. Are you seeing the benefits of a labor shortage?
Well, I think the economy is not, economic data is not bearing out that evidence. I mean, what we know is that, yes, it's true that there is low unemployment, and it is also true that wages continue to stagnate for the majority of working folks. While income has soared for the wealthiest in our country, everyone else's wages have stagnated and, in fact, aren't even keeping up with inflation. And so that really, I think, undermines the notion that working people in this economy can go out and just bargain for, you know, for the terms and condition of their employment. For people who live and work in the real world in this economy, they know that's not true. I mean, it's a fine, economics 101 argument to have in college dorms and classrooms. But for regular folks who live and work in our economy, who are the engine of our economy, it just absolutely rings hollow, and it's quite frankly not supported by any of the data.
So are we going to see labor asking for improvements for workers?
Well, I think we are seeing signs all over this state and all over this country that regular folks who work for a living have had enough. I think we're seeing growing, increasing signs that people understand that what is happening in our economy is not fair. And they want their elected officials to take those concerns seriously to act like adults and do their best to address these issues. If our elected officials, are welcome to propose other policies that they think will address these concerns. But while they continue to focus on issues that divide us, I think this is a clear message that the regular working folks in Texas are going to continue to demand that they take action on policy issues that could improve their everyday lives.
Well, is this going to show up at the ballot box? Will workers show up and say, I'm going to support candidates that support things like paid sick leave or expansion of health care or full funding of public education, things that workers typically support?
Well, I think we are about to find out. I think there are going to be a couple of really important races to watch here in the state of Texas this November. What I think we saw in Austin and Dallas and San Antonio is that there are hundreds of thousands of people who are thinking about these issues and who are ready and willing to take action on these issues. You know, you talked earlier about the process in San Antonio, and I think it was pretty clear that city council adopted this ordinance knowing that it would be adopted by the people overwhelmingly, by the people who live in San Antonio in November, if they sent it to the ballot. So, and I think that is evidence that people are going to be going to the polls with sort of basic, you know, bread and butter issues on their mind, thinking about how they make enough money to provide for their families, thinking about how they can improve their situation at home and at work.
Jose Garza is the executive director of the Workers' Defense Action Fund. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us wherever you get those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.